Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. That means you can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things we got going on over there. And while you're over there, there's probably something you need to sign up for. Maybe you like the Reformation. I mean, I like it. Chad likes it. It's a pretty interesting time. What just so happens at the Academy that Dr. Daniel Van Voorhis is teaching A Brief History of the Reformation, you can sign up for that for free. Learn about the Reformation from someone who's good at teaching about the Reformation at no cost to you. Why not do it? I've watched it all. I've seen all the class sessions, and it's quite good. I recommend if you want to just have a good time, or if you just are really interested in knowing more about the Reformation, go over there. The Academy is pretty cool, and there's a couple of different things you can sign up for. Maybe that's not your cup of tea. You can take Galatians with Rod Rosenblatt. You can learn about apologetics with Adam Francisco. Pretty soon, you're going to be able to learn about the Old Testament with Chad Bird over there at the Academy. I know that those are forthcoming. That's the next one up. Chad, why have you not taken the Reformation with Daniel Van Voorhis yet?
Well, I guess I was too busy getting ready for my own class.
I guess so.
That's the only excuse I could come up with.
But Chad's not taking the class, but even Chad knows the class is good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, I'll tell you, from someone who experienced being on the other side of the camera, I mean, they are done with such excellence that it amazes me. I mean, the people behind the scenes who are doing these, they know what they're doing. I mean, this is professional quality stuff. So I got to see some previews of some of the other material that's coming out, and just really, it's amazing work.
Yeah.
And so sign up. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Join the over 5,000 students that have went through the Academy classes. That's a lot of students. And, you know, you could be 5,001. And I think I've watched most of all of the Academy lectures. And yeah, they are, these aren't like someone sitting in their office with their iPhone, man. These are done really well. They're produced really well. Everything looks and sounds great. They're really cool. And so, and also a thing that they're doing, that Dan's doing, is sign up for that Reformation class. He's doing live webinars as well, where you'll get to interact with him periodically, ask him questions, that kind of stuff. Really cool. Go over the you can go to 1517, click on the Academy, and register for that. Chad, now, I mean, I'm almost hesitant to even say this because people will have limited time, but I guess I must. If you're in Texas and you listen to this the day it comes out or the day after it comes out, on Saturday, we'll be in Austin. We'll be at the City Event in Austin. So, you know, if you're in Texas, if you're one of those people that is just waiting for Thursday to come for the episode to drop, well, I'm talking to you. And if you're in Texas, we better see you in Austin, because me and Chad will be there with Donovan Riley and Valerie Locklear. And speaking of Daniel Van Voorhis, he'll be there, and the great Dr. Scott Keith. So we'll be doing that City Event in Austin. If not, and you're in the Midwest, next month we'll be in Des Moines, and then in May we'll be in Minneapolis. So there's lots of them for you to come to, and they're all free. So go over there and sign up. Just like the Academy, just like everything else, it's all free. So if you want to give back, hit that donate button on any site that's associated with 1517, and you can become a supporter. Thank you so much to those who do that. All right, Chad, I think that's all the things. We're about to head off into a new book. It's an exciting day.
It is an exciting day. Yeah, we're crossing the threshold from Numbers to Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
So it's exciting. I've been thinking about this a lot the last couple of weeks, and getting my thoughts in order, and just super excited about jumping into the fifth book of the Torah. So it's going to be some good stuff. It's a little bit different kind of book than what we've encountered so far. Its approach is different. Its language is different. Some of its themes are different. But of course, it's all overlapping with what we've covered before. So it's just a little bit different genre than we've encountered so far. But I think we're going to enjoy it. It's one of these books that is extremely influential throughout the rest of the Old Testament, as well as the New Testament. It's quoted several times in the Gospels and in Paul's epistles. So it's foundational, not only for the rest of the Old Testament, but for the New as well. So it's going to be a good, exciting journey.
Yeah, you know, and so in one way, Deuteronomy is the last book, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's actually, I talked about this in my in those lectures that we were just discussing with 1517 Academy about how the Torah is the foundation of the rest of the scriptures. And in many ways, once you get past Deuteronomy, everything after that is just inspired commentary on what's already been written. So Luther often talks about Moses being the fountain of the rest of the scriptures, to the well from which all the prophets and apostles and even Jesus himself drew their own writings. And he's got this great image. It's in his lectures on Deuteronomy where he talks about the footprints of the prophets are all over the book of Deuteronomy. Mm. You know, they're traveling back and forth all over it. So yeah, once you get past Genesis through Deuteronomy, once you get past the Torah, everything else is going to be an expansion of, an application of, an extrapolation of, a fulfillment of what we read in the Torah. So the Torah is like the Bible within the Bible. And everything else after that is going to be built upon this foundation.
Yeah, I mean, so when we hear Jesus use this language, you hear the apostles use this language of the law and the prophets. Well, after we finish this book, we will have completed what they're talking about when they say the law.
Yeah.
In the Jewish mind, when they say the law, they are speaking of Genesis through Deuteronomy.
Yeah, Moses, or sometimes called Moses, he's kind of the personification of the law or the law itself. Yeah, and as I have frequently pointed out, unfortunately, we're kind of stuck with that word law, even though in the Hebrew, it's called Torah, which doesn't mean law. It means teaching. So when you hear the word law, just do an automatic retranslation in your head, Torah or teaching, and that's going to help out because, of course, there's all kinds of teaching in the Torah. You got law, you got gospel, you got poetry, you got narrative, you got prophecy, you got all sorts of teachings in the Torah itself. And certainly part of that is law, but it's a collection of all different approaches that God takes to communicating his word to us. And when we see those various approaches in the Torah, then applied in all sorts of different situations in the rest of the scriptures.
Yeah. So like when David says, I love your law, he's saying, I love your teachings. And he is specifically talking about, in the narrow sense, he's talking about these five books. And so, in some ways obviously we're not done with the podcast, don't worry, after Deuteronomy, but there is sort of it is a finishing of something. Deuteronomy is the end of what the characters that you know of in scripture mean when they say the law or the teaching. And so it's kind of a cool thing that and Jesus himself says that when he says the law and the prophets speak of him, this is also what he is talking about, these books that we've been going through. So yeah, I'm excited to start it and sort of also excited to have completed a commentary walkthrough of these books, and then we will be on to a whole bunch of narrative and then into prophets and all this sort of stuff. But there is a sort of ending with this book, which is, but in a good way. It's good.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's hard to believe we've covered as much material as we have. I know we've been at it for a long time, but still it's a sizable amount of material of scripture to actually walk through verse by verse, chapter by chapter, through whatever, however many episodes that we have. And it's super exciting too that we have some people that have been walking with us, many of them from day one. So we've covered a lot of territory together, saw a lot of things, learned a lot of things, and we got a whole lot of more territory to cover. So it's going to be good.
All right, let's just jump into Moses' sermon.
Yeah, let's do it. So I want to say a couple things just by way of preface concerning the name itself. I don't know that we've always dealt with this with some of the other biblical books, but as everyone probably realizes, just like the chapter and verse divisions were added later, they weren't, of course, in the original. So also the names of the particular biblical books were not in the original. Of course, we title books today, but none of the biblical books were titled. That just wasn't a thing back then. So there's a couple of different ways that these books are named. I guess just in general, you could say there's a Christian naming of these books, and there is a Jewish naming of these books. And sometimes there's overlap between these two, but especially in the Torah, the names differ. So in this case, in the case of Deuteronomy, there's a definite divergence between the way these books are titled in Christian circles and then in Jewish circles. Typically, well, not exactly, but typically when the Jewish tradition named these five books of the Torah, what they did is they chose words often from the very opening of the book. And that's what they did in the case of Deuteronomy. So in the Jewish tradition, this book is not called Deuteronomy. It's called Eileh HaDavarim, which is nothing more than the opening couple of words from Deuteronomy. These are the words. So that's their name for Deuteronomy. These are the words. Eileh HaDavarim. We get Deuteronomy. This is kind of I don't know if it's funny to everyone, but it is kind of a funny in a geeky sort of way to me. We get the word Deuteronomy actually from a mistranslation, which I don't know. I find that pretty humorous. So Deuteronomy comes to us by way of, the Latin translation, but which is Deuteronomium, but the Latin translation got it from the Greek translation. So this comes from chapter 17, verse 18, which I want to talk about in just a second. But it's a translation of the Hebrew, which is the copy of the Torah. Basically, if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 18, it's in a section which is talking about the king of Israel, which, of course, they didn't have a king yet. But Moses is saying, hey, in the future, when you have a king, here's what the king is supposed to do. He is supposed to sit down, get a scroll, and make a copy of this Torah, which is probably a reference just to Deuteronomy itself. So that's one of the things that the king was supposed to do. He's going to make a copy of the Torah, write out the book, and then he's supposed to study it every day the rest of his life. So this phrase, the copy of the Torah, well, that got mistranslated into the Greek as the Deuteronomium tuto. So it's like this repetition of the law, something like that, which was misunderstood as like this second giving of the law, which is what Deuteronomy means, like a second law. So that particular translation, mistranslation in the Greek, got taken into the Vulgate, the Latin of the Vulgate, which got taken into our English translations. And so we end up with a biblical book that's named after a mistranslation.
Yeah, well, so this is not the only time in the church throughout church history where we have mistranslated Latin. There's other times we've mistranslated Latin with much worse results than just having a book name something that maybe isn't quite accurate.
Yeah, this is true. Such as do penance, right?
Exactly.
Is that what you're thinking of? Yeah.
Speaking of the Reformation, you can probably go learn about that at 1517 Academy. But yeah, there's certain mistranslations of things in Latin that can have some real negative consequences.
Yeah, and that's why, again, speaking of the Reformation, that's why Luther was constantly urging his own students to return to the original languages. I mean, that's why Hebrew and Greek was so significant to him, because especially those who are pastors, who are teachers, who are scholars, you know, one of their responsibilities is to delve into the original so that they're able to be assured that what they're writing or teaching or preaching is fitting with the original. So I mean, yeah, this is one of those cases where just a misunderstanding of the original language led to a mistranslation, which then ended up with us having a kind of a strange name for one of the biblical books. But we're stuck with it because it's been around for a long time. So we will call it Deuteronomy, but as we do, you can kind of keep in the back of your mind, this isn't a second law. It's not like Moses decided that the first one, wasn't enough, wasn't sufficient. So I'm going to give him a second law. It's not the case. This is more or less him summing up the law, applying it, and giving some encouragement, exhortation, and promises along the way. All right. Well, with that as the introduction, let's just jump right into the text itself. So these first almost four chapters are going to be a bit of a recap with a few unexpected twists and turns along the way of what we have been covering this far in the Torah. So he's going to go over a lot of Israel's history leading up to their entrance into the promised land, or their almost entrance into the promised land, because they're still sitting in the Transjordan right now listening to Moses preach. So these first almost four chapters are going to be familiar territory for us, although, as we will see already in this first chapter, there is a little bit different take on some of the earlier incidents in the life of Israel. So the first five verses are kind of setting the scene. Starts out, these are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel across the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arabah opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel and Levan and Hazarot and Dizahav. So he's just basically telling us, okay, this is where we're at. This is where Moses has erected his pulpit, as it were, from which he's going to preach to the people of Israel. And keep in mind that the people to whom he's preaching is the second generation, if you will. So the first generation of those who came out of Egypt, they're all dead, with the exception of Moses and Joshua and Caleb at this point. So those three alone are left of that original generation. Everybody else is new. So it's a relatively young nation that is about to enter into the promised land. And so part of what Moses is doing is it's kind of like, you know, when you tell young people about things that happen with their parents or their grandparents, this is the way you're passing along their family stories, their heritage, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Well, this is Moses speaking to this younger generation, saying, hey, I'm going to remind you of exactly what happened to us. Some of you weren't there. Some of you were. If you were very young, you might remember, you might not. But this is Moses' way of reminding them of their past and then going on after he does that to encourage them as they get ready to do what their parents were unwilling to do because of unbelief. So he starts out with kind of it's an implicit jab at what happened to the first generation. Verse 2 and verse 3 say this. Now, it's an 11 days journey from Horeb, that's Sinai, that's another name for Mount Sinai. In Deuteronomy, usually it says Horeb instead of Sinai for whatever reason, but same place. So it's an 11 days journey from Horeb or Sinai by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Then verse 3, and it came about in the 40th year. And on the first day of the 11th month that Moses spoke to all the children of Israel. So the implicit jab here is that, it's only 11 days walking on foot from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. And you know how long it took us to get to where we are now? Well, it took us 40 years to get to where we are now. So this is like one of those sort of inside jokes or implicit between the lines kind of indictments against Israel. You know, it took us a little bit longer than it should have to get to where we are now. You know, it was 11 days, and this is like 40 years later, and this is where we're now at. And the reason is, as he's going to go on and make explicit in the rest of the chapter, and the reason is your parents and your grandparents, they didn't trust in God to deliver on the promises which he had sworn to them and to their forefathers. They acted on unbelief. They trusted in their own strength. They gave in to fear instead of relying on faith. So that's why here we are, 11 days journey, 40 years later, at the spot that we're now at.
Yeah, I mean, as a representation of the law, Moses becomes a bad navigator, too.
Yeah.
I mean, people might be trying to tell you that the law is some tremendous guide. 11 days turned into 40 years. You know, it's not the greatest navigation tool. And as you said, what's the reason for this? It's because they didn't trust in God. It's not strictly because, like, well, they were a bunch of wretched sinners. The root of this taking an insanely longer time than it should have, is just unbelief. It's lack of trust in God. It's not clinging to His promises. It's wanting to do your own thing. It's wanting to go back to Egypt. It's all this mess. That's a not so subtle jab.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but the law can point you in the right direction, but it can't get you there, right?
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, so all you got to do is, yeah, this law. All you got to do is follow exactly what you're supposed to do, and everything's going to be great. But it can't get you there. In fact, what happens is when you put together the law and a sinner, 11 days turns into 40 years.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah, do this.
Talk about getting lost.
Yeah, do this and you shall live. Sounds easy enough. 40 years later, everyone's dead.
Yeah. Be ye perfect. That's all you got to do, and everything will be fine. Good luck with that. So we have the illustration of Israel, an illustration that never gets old, because this is exactly what continues to happen in the life of every single person, especially the more that we rely on the law to attain righteousness. Our 11 days become 40 years. So here they are. Verse 4 and 5 just is a little reminder about some victories that God has given them. It says, well, hey, we've defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. We kicked the butt of both those kings and their kingdoms. God gave us the victory. And so here we are. We're across the Jordan in the land of Moab. And so there it says Moses undertook to expound et HaTorah Hazot, this Torah. So this is the Torah, the teaching, the divine word that he is about to expound. So we start here in verse 6 with kind of going back to Horeb. Verse 6 has God speaking. It says, all right, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. If you remember, if you were with us way back in Exodus, they stayed a long time at Mount Sinai, over a year. So they got there pretty quickly. But then they stayed there a long time. You had the giving of the Ten Commandments. You had the rebellion of the golden calf. You had a plague. You had the establishment of the priesthood and the Levitical service and the construction of the tabernacle. There was a lot that happened at the foot of Mount Sinai. But verse 6 says that God finally said, okay, you've been here long enough. It's time to pull up stakes, literally, get your tents packed up, because we're on the move. So they went on their journey, and verse 7 and verse 8 is a reminder of the land that God was promising to give them. He says, you know, you're going to go to the hill country, the Amorites, and to all their neighbors in the Arabah, which is the southern part. The Arabah is the southern arid region of Israel. In the hill country, the lowland, and the Negev, and by the seacoast, the land of the Canaanites, and Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates. So this is kind of a picture of the boundaries of the promised land. In verse 8, God says, look, I have placed the land before you. We're going to hear this phrase again in latter part of the chapter, verse 21. But here he says, look, I have placed the land before you. Go in and possess the land in which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to them and their descendants after them. So this is Moses reminding this young generation that it's not like they escaped from Egypt and they wandered a while and they were like, you know what? We need to settle down. Let's find some land and just take it for ourselves. I mean, with enough planning and ingenuity and skill in warfare and a good amount of just luck, with all that, we'll be able to kick everybody out of this land and take it for our own. That's not the way it works. Instead, God has basically already given them the land. I mean, he remains the owner of the land. So the land, the Holy Land, it's the Holy Land because it belongs to God. That's why it's called the Holy Land. It's his possession. And so Israel, when they possess it, they're never going to own the land. They remain as tenants on the land. So they settle there. God lets them settle there. But just like, you know, say you owned a section of land and you let some of your friends build a house there or hunt there or farm there, raise a few cattle there. Well, maybe you're going to charge them some rent, or maybe you're just going to do it out of the goodness of your heart. Whatever the reason is, just because they're there doesn't mean they own the land. Just because they work there doesn't mean they own it. You own the land, and you just let them settle there or work there or hunt there. Well, that's like it is in the Holy Land, too. It's God's land. It always remains his possession. And so Israel is just allowed to be tenants there, to settle there, to work there. So all this land, he says, I place before you. It's going to be my land as a gift to you. And all you have to do is go in and basically settle there, possess it. So I've done all the work for you. In other words, it's a gift. It's laid out there for you. It's not like something that you have to work for. Go in, possess the land that I have already given to you as a gift. So we're going to come back to that in a second. But first of all, he has a couple of other things he needs to say. So verse 9 and following, it's kind of, I don't quite completely understand why Moses chooses this particular incident to record here, although I might have an idea. But what he chooses to record, of all the things he could have chosen to talk about from the past, he talks about in verses 9 and following that the situation was that Israel had multiplied. They were no longer a tiny nation. They were a large nation. He says that they had multiplied like the stars of heaven. So they're a big nation, whole lot of people. And Moses says, look, I'm glad that this is the case, and may God continue to give you growth, and may Israel continue to expand. But it's too much for me. He says in verse 9, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone because God has blessed you so much. And so what I want to do is I'm going to choose some wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and they're going to be appointed as leaders and judges. So you know, if you have a dispute, you go to them. They take care of it. If it's too difficult, they come to me, and I will help out with that. And then he goes on to say that these judges, when people bring their situations, their lawsuits to these judges, that they are not to show partiality in judgment. That's a major theme, of course, to the rest of the Old Testament. Mishpat in Hebrew is a word for justice, and that's a recurring theme, especially through the prophets, because there was no mishpat, there was no justice. Instead, there was injustice. So Moses is saying here, when the people bring their problems to you, then don't show any partiality. You shall hear the small and the great alike. It doesn't matter if they're poor or rich, if they have no power, if they have a whole lot of power. You shall fear man, he said. You shall not fear man, he says, for the judgment is God's. So he and he alone, through the dictates of his word, is going to be the one who guides you in your decision-making process.
In the Old Testament and in the New Testament, you do see this come up over and over and over again. Apparently, showing partiality is a very human problem. Because this is not something that God says once. This happens over and over and over again. It comes up over and over again. It comes up in the New Testament. It comes up when talking about the church. We have this this tendency to show favoritism, show partiality, to honor certain status, and so he does equate then the sort of idea of justice with impartiality. In other words, where there is partiality, like there can't be, justice can't really thrive there. Partiality is like the fertile ground for injustice to grow in.
Yeah, you could say the same about love too. You know, where there's partiality, then not only justice, but love suffers. And you mean, we could come up with example after example of this in the life of the church, as well as our individual lives. You know, if a famous person walks into your church, then he or she is going to be treated differently than if an anonymous person just chooses to visit your church Sunday.
Or a homeless person.
Yeah, or a homeless person. Yeah, yeah. So there is this built-in tendency that we have to attribute some sort of almost divine status to people who, for whatever reason, are rich or powerful or something like that. It is a symptom of our fallen condition, where when we see people, within a split second, we automatically make judgments about them, and that then translates into how we treat them, whether it's good or bad or somewhere in between. That's the reason there is this ongoing warning throughout the Old and New Testament not to show partiality, because if there is a human trait that is universal and that raises its ugly head all the time, it is that showing of partiality. I mean, I do it. All sinners do it. I mean, it's just something that we have to constantly battle against. And it works both ways. I mean, it doesn't matter if you show favoritism to the rich or show favoritism to the poor. If you show favoritism to the powerful or the powerless, either way, I mean, the drunk man walking down the road can fall into either ditch. I mean, that we can go either way. What we're striving for is equity, and basically looking at every person and seeing in their face the image of God and treating them in a way that reflects that reality, not looking at them and seeing what color skin they are or how well they're dressed or whether they're a man or woman or anything like that, seeing in them the reflection of the image of God and then acting accordingly by treating them with love and justice and equity. But because of these snap judgments that we make based upon all sorts of assumptions that we have, we hardly ever treat people in that way. And so there's this repeated warning against that through Scripture.
Yeah, and part of the reason that this is brought up over and over again, I think, is because non-partiality is at the heart of the gospel, because we actually will see Paul talk about this numerous times, where he'll say in regard to salvation that God shows no partiality. This is to say that righteousness is a zero-sum game. In other words, you are either righteous or you are not. Like there's not degrees here. This person's a little bit righteous, and this person's not so much righteous. No, it's like pregnancy. Like you either are or you're not. And this, guess what? You're not. So this puts us all in the same boat. So God shows no partiality when looking at sinners. He sees them all the same. But he shows no partiality in his dying, where he dies for the world. And so for this reason, then, the gospel and the good news of what God has done for sinners in Christ is also a universal message. And we're not to show any partiality to anyone based on who they are, what they've done, whatever it is, that we know that God is for them. And so as we go around, then, the reason we are instructed over and over and over again to not show partiality when dealing in matters of justice is that's not how God has dealt with us. It's not how God has dealt with humanity.
Yeah, so the gospel ultimately determines our, I guess you could say, our anthropology. The gospel determines how we look at other people, right? How we look at ourselves. And it provides that necessary lens through which we understand who we are in Christ and thus how we are to interact in love and justice toward each other. And that traces its way all the way back to Deuteronomy and even before then. So it was a concern, an ongoing concern in the life of Israel, just as an ongoing concern in the life of God's church today. And so Moses warns the judges of his day to beware of this tendency, and instead to not fear man, but instead to fear God and to judge according to his word and not to the dictates of their own human hearts. So that ends with verse 18, that first section. From verse 19 through basically the rest of the chapter, he's going to go back to what happened when that first generation had left Horeb and were on the verge of entering into the land of promise. So we'll get started with this. I'm sure we'll have to finish it up in the next episode. But verse 19, he says, we set out from Horeb. We went through that great and terrible wilderness, which you saw on the way to the hill country, the Amorites, just as the Lord our God had commanded us. And then we came to Kadesh Barnea. And Moses says, this is verse 20, all right, you've come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is about to give us. There's that language of gift once more. See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken. Do not fear or be dismayed. So this is Moses setting everything up. Here we are. I mean, look at what we've come through. We were slaves in Egypt. God brought us out of slavery. We were trapped at the Red Sea. God brought us through the waters. We camped at Sinai, where he gave us his law. He gave us the priesthood. He gave us the tabernacle. He's brought us through the great and terrible wilderness. And here we are at the brink of the promised land. This is the land that God has just laid out there before us. He promised this to our fathers. And so go take possession of it and don't fear and don't be dismayed. And what's the response to the people? Verse 22. Moses says, then all of you approached me and said, let's send men before us that they may search out the land and bring back word to us of the way by which we should go up and the cities which we shall enter. There's a couple of different accounts here. We talked about a couple of different reasons given for why this happened. So when we covered Numbers 13 and 14, which is the first time this incident is recorded, there in Numbers, it presents this idea of sending spies as if it were God's idea. He says, send some guys into the promised land. Here, we have a little bit different retelling of that story. Here, Moses says that it was the people's idea. So which is it? I was thinking about the connection between these two, and we'll see some other examples like this later in Deuteronomy too, where there's a little bit different focus on the story itself. And I think there's no contradiction here. I think the best way to understand these two parallel retellings is that the people themselves were hesitant. Moses said, don't be fearful or dismayed, and yet they were fearful and dismayed. And so they wanted to, you know, kind of put their toe in the water. Let's go see what it's like. Let's just send some spies ahead and let them kind of scout out the land and bring back a report to us of, yeah, what it's going to be like, how we should go, how we should plan. And then as a response to that, God was like, okay, I will yield to your weakness. God often does that in the scriptures. So go ahead and send these spies ahead to scout out the land. So I don't think there's any kind of contradiction between these two stories, just like there's not a contradiction in the various tellings of Jesus' miracles and parables in the Gospels. It's just a little bit different way of approaching the story. And I suspect, given what happened, that this is actually what transpired. The people were hesitant. God yielded and said, all right, out of concern for your own weakness, then that's what we will do. We'll send some spies ahead. So that's what they did. Verse 23 says, this thing pleased me. This is Moses talking. And so he took 12 men and they each went up. They spied out the land. They brought back some of the fruit of the land and they brought it back down to us. And they brought back the report of the land. And they said, it's a good land, which the Lord our God is about to give us. Yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. Now, I don't want to end on a negative note, but that's kind of where the text has brought us. What I think that what we need to talk about next time is how doubt gives way to unbelief, and then unbelief continues to grow until it grows to the point of what we're going to see in verse 27, where they actually attribute false motives to God for bringing them out of the land of Egypt to begin with. So we'll flesh that out more in the next episode. But this is going to be a classic case of how doubt precedes unbelief, unbelief proceeds even further. And we're going to see that the issue was not so much the people's immorality or the people's disobedience with regard to certain commands, but the issue was unbelief. That becomes the fountainhead of all particular sins and iniquities. And so we'll see how all that transpires in the next episode.
Yeah, you know, something that's cool about Deuteronomy is in a lot of ways you sort of have Moses exegeting the people's history of the last 40 years. Like, let me explain to you what was going on here in truth. Here's what was really going on. So, like, we know this story because we've already talked about it in Numbers. But now Moses is telling you what was really going on in all of this stuff. So it is a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that Deuteronomy is makes very clear is that this sermon is basically taking the history of the people of Israel, and it is theologizing. It's making explicit what was implicit in the narrative before. So we'll see plenty of that as we proceed.
All right.
It's good to get started.
Absolutely. Guys, if you're in Texas and you're listening to this, me and Chad will be in Austin this weekend. We'd love to see you. If not, hey, we'll see you next week. Chad, I'm going to see you this weekend, and then I'll see you next week again.
Looking forward to it.
All right.
See you then.